This is the Christmas seminar on the topic, Next Step, Illumination. I'm spiritually illumined. This is lecture 3, Making the Connection. Making the Connection. How many of you have thought about making the connection? Very interesting idea, making the connection. How do you make the connection between your awareness of your human body and your awareness of your spiritual reality? Now, there's a great gulf in between, a great distance in between your human body and your spiritual body. And it's a very simple thing to make the connection, but it's very demanding. We have lived in our human bodies, and we have lived in our human attitudes for so long that we have forgotten why we have come to this experience, why we have come to planet Earth in the first place. We've come here to remember who we are. We are divine beings. We are one, we are all, we are the allness, we are the oneness, we are illumination. But we have walked away from that path so long that we have thought that we are not illumination. And of course, it's easy to do. Now, we've been practicing our role for a long time. And Ellen Jeremini is Ellen Jeremini. And she was born with a bunch of other names, and she was expected to be a girl. And she was expected to be a little lady. And she was expected to be the daughter of her mother and father. She was expected to be a representation of their family. She was expected to be a lady of quality and class. She is expected to be all sorts of things. But her mother and father didn't plan on her becoming a corporate executive. They didn't plan on her becoming the head of a church organization. They didn't plan on her becoming the head of a university or several universities. They didn't plan. You see, though the organizations may be a little small now, they can be very large in a very short time, if we want to put forth the effort to let them be there. But that's who Ellen Jeremini is. Now, when Ellen Jeremini came to the University of Healing, she had many misconceptions. One misconception was that she was a limited person, that she could not speak many languages. She knew them, but she couldn't speak them. Well, we helped her dissolve that that illusion very quickly. She thought that she couldn't be a sponsor for seminars. She became that very quickly. She thought she couldn't give seminars herself. My goodness sakes, that would be beyond all imagination. And the next thing you know, there she is out giving seminars in Russia and in Africa and in Guyana and all around the United States, doing it and doing wonderfully. Now, some were well attended, some weren't. Doesn't matter. Each seminar that she gave, each lecture that she gave it as though she were speaking to the entire universe. She gave it with all her heart and all her mind. Where did she get that inspiration to do that? She had been living so long thinking that she was just a simple person, just working on simple little things and nothing complex like that. Now, how did she make the transition? The transition is a tough thing to make. It's a tough thing to make when you think you can't to being that you can. But she did it just little by little, just sort of slipping into the role without thinking a thing about it. Now, many of you are doing the same type of thing. You're slipping into roles that you think nothing about it. Now, Christina, she came to campus, and she was at the 3-month school of the master and was exceptionally bright, exceptionally brilliant, exceptionally spiritually illumined. She was everything going great. And then she decided to go back to her home in Switzerland and to live her normal life. And when she did that, she immediately took all of the genius that she had developed, all the genius that she had been aware of, and set it aside for the time being. Not crossing it off, but just setting it aside. Now, How could she do that? How could she slice her life? One moment she is a normal lady in Switzerland. The next moment she's taking a 3-month seminar on spiritual management and so forth. And then after that 3 months is over, after the period of time she stayed on campus, then she just went boom, right back to being a lady in Switzerland. Now, how can she do that? I mean, that takes a great step in attitude, a great step in a genius to do that, because each one of the roles that she presumed, that she assumed, she did with great ability, great intelligence and so forth, but they're totally different. They're totally different. And you say, well, do they have to be totally different? Yeah. One, she dedicated to her personal spiritual goals and her personal spiritual life. And the other, she dedicated to other people. She dedicated to fulfilling the needs of other people and what their expectations of her were. Now, that's a totally different thing. Now, Gertrude, she raised 3 children, and then she got them out of the house finally, and they got married, and they have their own families, and next thing you know, their families are back in Gertrude's home again. And so she's raising another set of children, and she's just having a ball. But what happened? Here she raised them. She got them out of her out of the house. She was doing her own thing, living her own wonderful life, walking her own wonderful path. And then, boom, she's back into the path of raising the other children. And then one day, when the children are back with their families and so forth, permanently, boom, she'll be back doing a different thing. And how can she go from zip to zip to zip to zip like that and still maintain a balance? You know? How can she do that? How can any of you do that? Each one of you have had some very demanding experiences in your life. Sylvia, she came from a very modest arrangement in life with no great demands on her. She was just enjoying life and smoothly sailing along. And then all of a sudden she found this philosophy and she thought it was great. And so she came here and all of a sudden she was whipped into a great many activities, great many talents that she never knew she had. And she blossomed just like a rose in showing them. And then she says she'd like to go and give seminars, or she'd like to go and do this. That's a whole nother ball of wax. But can she do it? Nope, she can't do it. Now, why can't she do it? Because she doesn't go do it. That's all it takes to do it, is to go do it. Now, she likes to stay here. She likes to do this. We could send her off to give seminars, but that would be no good, because the thing is, she doesn't feel confident in doing it yet. But she will. And one day when she does, then she'll say, I didn't realize I could have done this all along. I have the talent. I could have done it any time. It wouldn't have made any difference, you know? And Rhonda, silly girl, she gets over her husband's, and then she is walking free and easy, just having a wonderful time with life, enjoying herself, learning from the University of Healing and learning from her own family and having her son be one of her best teachers and just having a great time in life. And then she all of a sudden spoke out of turn and she said, I love you. I want to marry you. And then she had a burden on her hands. And this burden became an individual who wanted her to be in his life, and she wanted to be in his life and wanted him in her life. But she didn't realize, how many times was she married? 37 times? She had married 3 times. Now, do you think during those 3 times of being married, she would have realized that marriage is possession? And that every time you get married, you are possessed by each other. You tell your husband when you go someplace, you tell your wife when you go someplace, you don't dare do anything without letting your husband or wife know, because that's inconsiderate of them. Did they know what you were doing before you got married? Were you a good person before you got married? Why wouldn't you be a good person after you got married? Why do they have to be judge and jury of what your actions are when you're married when they weren't before? But that's another story. But she did this, and you think she would have learned. But she loves it. She loves to be possessed. She thinks that to be possessed is one of the most glorious experiences of the world. And she may go for 4 or 5 or 10 or 20 times to be married. There are some people who do that, you know. Liz Taylor and a few of the others, you know. They thoroughly enjoy that entrapment. And they have enough money that they can buy their way out of the marriages without too much difficulty. But so be it. So be it. Ingeborg, what about you? What about you? You were working for a corporation, and you were their secretary, and you were their Girl Friday, and you did a good job, and you had many jobs before that. And then all of a sudden, you come here to campus. And all of a sudden, campus activity just seems pretty good. And you do work in translating into Italian, you do the mailing, you do all of these different jobs here. And how can you switch from one to the other? Did you know that you were switching? Did you know that you were making the change? It just sort of naturally flowed into the way, didn't it? Now, what was it doing when it was flowing into the way like that? What was it doing? That's the way, Ellen. Really open it up right on face. What was it? A little more. Close it for her eyes. We have the light shining in through the window here, right into our eyes as we're sitting here looking at me. And I don't want anything to disturb them from looking at me. Right? Right. Okay. Now, we're talking about making the connection between our spiritual self and our human self. And is it possible to make the connection? And of course, most of you know the answer already, that it's not possible. You cannot connect the human and the spirit. Though the spirit is coming out of though the human is coming out of the spiritual self, the human self is a totally different ball of wax than the spiritual self. The spiritual self, well, let's just cover a few points on there. The spiritual self is unlimited. The human self is limited. The spiritual self knows everything. The human self only knows what it educates itself to know or thinks. The spiritual self, snaps its finger. If the spiritual self had fingers, it would snap its finger and it would be instantly done, whatever it thinks about. The human self thinks, and that's the first thought. The second thought is plan, and the third thought is action. And so the human self has to go through all this rigmarole to accomplish what it chooses to do. Now, when the human thought merges with the spiritual thought, then what has to go? The human thought has to go. The human thought no longer has a place once it realizes in its spiritual path that it is all. It is not a becoming. It is, yes, Ellen says, see, now I told you that. See, it's not a becoming. It is something of a reality. So the human self sort of fades or dissolves as the spiritual self takes over. Now, was the spiritual self always there? Was the spiritual self always as dominant and as capable and as responsive as it always is? Yes, it is. Well, then why do we give power to the human self when we know the spiritual self is so totally perfect, so totally complete, so totally wonderful? Well, the spiritual self, at least our attitude toward it, has been that if you can't see it, it might not be real. And you cannot see the spiritual self. But I would ask you questions like this. Can you see life? You know what life is? Life is that energizing thing about you that keeps your body moving. Now, can you see love? That's a very invisible thing, but you believe in it. You talk about it. Can you see charisma? Charisma is the, you can see it?
Well, actually, it's more an expression of charisma, like life and love, but you can't see it.
You can't see it. You see, all the things that are, as Ellen just said, vibrations, all the things that are the significant things in our life are vibrations. They are things that we cannot see, things that we cannot know about, things that we cannot understand. And yet we believe in them. But the only thing we find trouble believing in is what we call spirit. What is spirit? What is our divine self? What is that reality of us that never changes, that never dies, that never is born? What is that? Well, we can perhaps conclude that that is the very thing that we are. That is the essence of all that is. Sort of talking around the barn there. What is our spiritual self? Well, it is the invisibility of us. But when you stop and think, our spiritual self is the archetypal concept of whatever it is that we outpicture in our human body, whatever it is we outpicture in our spiritual self, whatever it is that we are. Now, an archetypal concept is the prototype, the beginning type, the essence. We have a concept of a house, and the concept of house is a universal concept. It's, so to speak, four walls and a roof and a ceiling and perhaps rooms inside. But it's four walls and a door and window, of course, and things like that. But that's a house. Now, we think of house, we say my house, and my house has windows and doors and bathroom and kitchen and living room and bedroom and all that sort of thing. And then we think of Bill Gates's house with 200,000 square foot of space in his house, something like that, some outrageous thing. And that's his home where he lives, you know. And I mean, how can you live in so much space? This here is quite a pleasant house, and we are something like 4,000 square feet here. And it's quite large. But you start getting into some fancier homes. You get into, maybe it's only 20,000, but it's a lot of square feet. I was reading about it in one of the money magazines the other day, and it said that when they walk around their house, they have special sound systems throughout the house that hear the breathing and the sensitivity for the people who are passing through, and plays music according to the vibrations of the people who are passing through. You know, very subtle background music. And the people think their thought and the doors open, and I mean, it's an amazing house. Truly electronic. Truly electronic. But it was electronic. It's old-fashioned. It's at least 4 years old, you know. And a lot has happened since then, you know, or maybe even 10 years, because he's been a long time building that. But you see, today, if Bill Gates were to build the same house, it would be a totally wireless house. It's pretty wireless now the way it is, but it would be totally wireless. It would not even have wires in the walls. It would just be a house that would be responding to a wireless life. And the more you get into this high-tech stuff, now repeat that, the more you get into this high-tech stuff, the closer you are to how we relate with our God self. You know? You might say, our divinity is the master comm. It is the master format. And our individuality is the robots, you know, the little things that operate out of it. And it is operated on a wireless arrangement between our divinity and ourself. And at the moment, we think of ourselves as being rather separate from our divine self. And pretty soon, we will stop sending code from our divine self to ourself, and we will incorporate a chip in ourself which will have our divine code in it. And then we will be one as the all and all as the one. But still, there will be the differentiation, because the all can and does do everything, whereas the uniqueness needs the all through which to operate. It needs the source of power that the all operates under. Because the all is the energy, is the power, is the source. And we utilize that. We are like the light bulb. We are no good without the power source. But we are very good with the power source. We are like the telephone or the telegraph. We are like the radio or television. We were saying at the table the other day to Gertrude, "Gertrude, you got miracles going all the time." She says, "Yeah, I know." And I said, "Just think of it. You can take your portable television set out in the middle of the desert, no matter where it may be, out in Africa or in America or wherever, and you can tune in to television shows that come in over the wireless system, and with pictures and sound and good sound, really high quality sound that any audiophile would thoroughly enjoy listening to. You understand that? And that's amazing. Now, it's through wireless. Why anyone would use wires anymore is hard to understand. Because through the wireless, you can have the exquisite sound. You can have the exquisite pictures. You can have the high fidelity of all. And you're not limited by the wires themselves. So they've just gone through great expense throughout the United States, at least, and other countries, I'm sure, in putting in these new wire systems, you know. They're fiber optic, they call it. And the fiber optic system works on sending through hundreds and thousands of signals through one channel. And you say, how can they do that? Well, how can they do that? How can they send it through the air? There's so many wonderful things that are going on. And again, just to boggle our mind a bit, think of the Hubble satellite, you know, that is out there photographing things. It was supposed to be dead a while ago, but its batteries regenerate itself somehow and start sending back signals of things that it's taking pictures of out there, sending back pictures from outer space on such antique technology. You know, that technology was 20 years ago or better. When did the Hubble go up? It was quite a while ago. And yet it is still high quality stuff. It's amazing that we'll get to the point where we don't need to have a device to send it. We don't need to have technology of the humankind to bring about information from whatever we wish it to be. We already have that ability, but we're not using it. We do use it. I must admit that. We do use it. When do we use it? Anybody? When do we use the technology that is wireless and everything else, and it's ours to use?
Telephone.
I'm sorry?
Email and telephone, yeah.
Anybody?
Garage door opener.
What?
Garage door opener.
I can't hear you.
Garage door opener?
No. When we are sleeping and dreaming, we are using the highest technology you could use. We have movies in our sleep that are just outstanding. We have video and sound and color, which is the most amazing thing in the world. And we have the capacity to see our entire life story go for our eyes just before we die or something like that. You know, like you're going to drown or something, and then all of a sudden it goes right through your mind, and you remember everything of your life. And if you had the capacity to comprehend everything you saw, not just a little bit that you remember, you'd be amazed that your entire biographical sketch is passing through your mind with color, with sound, with Every person who was involved in it at that time, at that age, at that experience, hey, if you want to, you can go back into your mind, not back, but you can go into your mind, and you can live any adventure of your world or of anybody. You are all, so you're Napoleon and you're Jesus and you're everything else, you know, plus all the little big people in between. But you could click into the now, into any experience that ever is, and enjoy it right now in the fullness and in the full scope of its relevance to its time in its day. Amazing, you know? But these are things that are possibilities for us, and perhaps one day we will, as we begin to merge in awareness with our illumination. We haven't even begun to understand the possibilities of the things that we could do. We haven't even begun to understand it. The things that we can accomplish and the ideas that we can accomplish. And we say here, making the connection. How do we make the connection? Well, I've been giving you a few examples. You make the connection when you dream. But you think, oh, dreams are telling you of unhappy things that are happening. Dreams are telling you this or that. No, dreams aren't. Dreams are just living in the now, your activities on other dimensions, on other awarenesses. But it's all in the now. And if you were to latch on to any one of your so to speak, dreams, you could be living that real as you're living this real. All are illusion. But you could be living any one of those things. But just think, wouldn't it be interesting, just for the heck of it? Well, no, you're doing it. I'm thinking, when I was a child, we had our lake cottage. And every summer we would go out to the lake, and we would be out there for about 2 days. And then Mother would do her job on us. We would all be burned to a cinder. And she would have to put salve, she'd put butter on us, you know, and to make it not be hurting so much. And then we would go to bed that night, and the next morning our bed would just be loaded with dead flesh, you know, that had come off of us, it peeled off, and then she'd take it out, we'd all shake it outside. And then we had our tan for the summer, and we were all set. It was just a short few months, but we could not put clothes on. We could not cover up and go gradually with a suntan. We had to go all in all, you know. And it wasn't whether we were 5 years old or 10 or 15, whatever it was, we had to go out and get that first burn. And of course, the scientists today tell you all sorts of fascinating things about it. But that's your choice to believe. It's your choice whether you want to give that any credence or not. Now, do I see that? Do I remember that? Can I visualize that? Can I see our little red bodies all being soaked up with butter and all being made to feel a little better? And we knew when we went to bed that night that it was going to hurt just a little bit. But in the morning, we'd have to shake out the bed. It's always happened that every summer, we'd have the initial days of summer in tanning. But it was great. Now, I'm right there. My mind is right there. I'm seeing it right there. I'm living in that moment, which is now. And you live in that moment, which is now. And this is in color. This is in color. And this is with all things. But you know, one thing about dreams, and this is a fun thing. Dreams do not need to be factual. Dreams do not need to be factual. As I visualized myself at our summer cottage, all burned up like that, I see Mother sitting on the swing on the front yard that Pop had built, and we are standing in front of her naked, and she's putting all this butter all over us and stuff. And when we were doing this, when I was at the age that I remember, the swing wasn't there. That didn't come till later. But we used it later, too. But I remember me younger having her do that with the swing there, even though the swing wasn't there until later. But we can rearrange the facts in our story, and I didn't mind that factually it wasn't exact, because it didn't bother me. It's not significant. Nothing in life is significant. Like, again, Richard Bach in Illusions has the statement come up, we can rearrange the past, the future, the present. We can clip the film and paste it together in any arrangement we want. And that's only too true. We can take the experiences that we have and rearrange them. Now, what has that got to do with our illumination? Well, our illumination is that everything is exactly the way we want it. Exactly the way we want. What kind of a life would you like to have? As you visualize, you're going to continue being human beings. And as you visualize yourself as illumined beings, what kind of a life do you visualize yourself having? Do you visualize yourself having no interest in your family anymore? Do you visualize yourself having no interest in your pets? Do you visualize yourself having no interest in eating or sleeping or drinking or doing other things? Is that how you visualize yourself? Whatever you want, that's okay. But you don't have to. Because an illumined being merely has a higher perceptivity of the beauty of life. And that's kind of nice. An illumined being merely has a higher perceptivity of the beauty of life. So think of that. When your perceptivity of the beauty of life is growing up, 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 you can realize you're being illumined. When Joan of Arc was approached by, when she approached the king and said, you know, I can help you win the battle, and the king thought, well, what the heck, you know, we're losing, anything that'll help. And the king says, go for it. And then when the church asked her how she gained such power and such understanding, having been just a little maid, country maid herself, with no training, she said, God told her to do it, and God told her what to do. Well, now, the church said that's not acceptable, because God only speaks through the priests and only through the hierarchy of the church, and the king, of course, but does not speak through some simple little person like she was. Well, she said, God spoke to me. And so they didn't agree. But you see, she had to make a great decision whether to say, hey, I think it was God anyhow, you know. And that way she wouldn't have been burned at the stake. But she said it was God, because she said, the voice said, this is God speaking, and this is what I want you to do. That's why she believed so thoroughly in what she was doing. Well, now, do you have anything, maybe not quite so dramatic like that, as God saying, do this? Now, Donald Simota said, remember, that if God were to come right to you and speak right to your face and say to you, do whatever pleases you and go and have fun in life, would you do it? And the answer is no. You wouldn't do it. Because you cannot conceive of God being so generous with you. You think that God would say, get down on your knees, you know, you rascal, you unhumbled person, you know, praise me and worship me and give offerings to my priests who are working for me. You got to take care of them. Well, actually, if the priests were God's chosen men to do the job, they would not need any money. God would take care of them from that point of view. He would give them independent wealth, you know, and he would give them circumstances where people just want to come and do things for them and want to come and take care of them and want to come and give. And, of course, that's what the priests taught the people to do, to come with their 10% and so forth. But, you see, we don't feel worthy. We don't feel worthy, so we go out and we threaten the world that it has to be nice to us. Instead of going out and just being nice to the world, and what happens to people who go out and are nice to the world? Sometimes the world likes them and sometimes it doesn't. You can never be sure. Because sometimes the world says, you're too good to be true, or where'd you steal that money? You know? Well, I told you about the boy who, my grandniece who went to visit Santa Claus, and she said to Santa Claus she wanted snow for a Christmas present. And the next morning when she woke up, it was snowing, and she said, "Grandma, look, it's snowing. Santa Claus gave me my snow." Well, now, what can you do about that? Can you speak your word to Santa Claus and say, "I would like independent wealth"? Can you speak your word to your divinity, the divine within you, and say, "I am independently wealthy. I live in my ideal spirit, mind, and body. I'm whole and perfect"? Could you say that? Well, if you are whole and wealthy, if you are independently wealthy, if you are all these good things, then you did say it. Because you do not have it unless you put the cause in motion. And if you have nothing, if you have limitation, you put that cause in motion too. So we want to learn to put the cause in motion for our highest and our best. We want to learn to make the connection between our divine self and our self. Our divine self is not really separate from us, but we have made a separation. I know of families where the children were not very nice, and the father said, "I don't ever want to see you again." He made a separation between them and himself. Now, he may have made a mental separation or an emotional separation, but he could not make a physical separation because he was one with his children. His sperm were in his children, his genes, his chromosomes, his reality was in the children. He could not excommunicate them from his family circle. And some fathers try to do that, and some mothers, but you can't do that. Physiologically speaking, you cannot do that. So how do you think it is spiritually speaking? Do you think you could ever be excommunicated from your divine self?
No.
People feel that way and act that way. People feel that they are unworthy, and being unworthy, they cannot turn to the divine within them and proclaim the truth about themselves. They feel that unworthiness, and then they feel little. It's just like my story, which I tell so often. I say to you, "Who took my pencil? I had a pencil on the desk in the other room there, and it's missing. And you're the only one that walked through that room. Now, where did you put my pencil?" "I didn't see your pencil." "And yes, you did. Yes, you did. You took it." Well, you would begin to feel guilty, even though you didn't even think of the pencil. You didn't even know the pencil was there. The pencil was not any of desire of yours at any point. But yet you were proclaimed as the thief of the pencil. What do you feel? Your first thought is not of hatred or not of anger. Your first thought is, "Gee, I sure'd like to get him his pencil back." You know, it doesn't matter who it's from or who took it or not. "I got an extra pencil here, let me give you this," you know. And, no, "I want my pencil, I don't want your pencil," you know. But this is the feeling within humanity. We immediately want to make amends for what we're blamed for, whether we did it or whether we didn't do it. And then we go on, and we get to feel guiltier and guiltier and guiltier until finally we think we stole that pencil. We think honestly that we stole that pencil, that that's the truth. And when we get to that point, there's no salvation for us. There's no change for us, because who could prove that we did or didn't? Because we believe we did now that we've been brainwashed to the fact that we certainly were the only ones to walk through that room, the only ones. Well, a little later, I was opening a pack of paper in my house just a short time ago, and part of the paper had the label off of it, and I noticed it was chewed off. So some rodent out in the Shangri-La has been eating on our paper stock and was chewing into there and ate into it. And I thought, you know, a mouse could have stole the pencil. But you know what I think? And you remember this in case I ever use the illustration again. The pencil wasn't there in the first place. You know? The pencil was not there in the first place. Because why would he think someone stole it if no one took it? If no one took it, it probably wasn't there in the first place. He probably forgot where he put it. Now, Rhonda, do you ever put your glasses in your hair and then wonder where you put them? Yeah. This is a normal human attitude. Where are my glasses? I know I had them here just a minute ago. They're on top of your head, you know. And you just don't see it. But you feel so stupid when somebody tells you they're on your head, you know. But that is a normal attitude that people have. And it's a normal action that they have. They just move them up so that they can see with their other vision. But we feel guilty. We allow ourselves to feel guilty. Now, if you feel guilty over something so unimportant as that, imagine what you feel about something that you did do, something that you did not do, something that you should have done, like to believe in yourself. Are there people who can go to Lourdes and various other places and be healed? And they cannot be healed somewhere else? They go everywhere and they're not healed. They go to Lourdes and they're healed. They believe. But now, it's not just that. They may go to, I don't know the names of all these other healing places, but they may go to healing place X, healing place Y, healing place Z, that are very good, that people get healings from all the time. But they didn't get one there. But they went to Lourdes, and there they got it. Now, do you think they're believers in Lourdes? And is that really the healing agency? It was within themselves. It was within themselves, but they thought it was in an outer form. Well, we do the same thing. We fail to look within ourselves and say, I am God, God I am. I am divine, divine I am. I am the oneness, the allness, the truth, the way and the truth and the light. I am that I am. You see, as we start affirming these things, we start connecting ourselves with our reality. We start connecting ourselves with just who and what we are. Now today, during the pause, I decided to go and get the tractor and push the tree off of the road so we could drive around the road. This gigantic tree, some 100 feet, 120 feet high, fell right down on our yard. It was supposed to fall because it was dead for a long time. But fortunately, it came down. And it went into the road 2 or 3 feet on one side and about 10 feet on the other side. And so I went over to get the tractor. And I had my terry cloth robe on, and I was driving along, and the robe comes open, and the cool breeze comes in, and ooh, that's nice, you know. And so I took the tractor, and I shoved the tree off the road. Then I shoved the tree off the road from the other side. And it got off the road pretty good. And I cleaned up. And I thought, well, as long as I got the tractor out, I might as well just take a pass over my walkway that Heinz had made for me so nicely. And so I put the back of the gurney down, and I went through my path. And it straightened it out very nice. And then I went through the other path. Then I went behind Ellen's house. And then I went back again and made a couple more passes. It'll take another pass or so to make it perfect, but it's almost fantastic. But now, I had had that picture in my mind for a couple of weeks that I'd like to have that done. And I went out there and I worked on it for perhaps 30 minutes and did the whole thing. actually the tractor did the whole thing. But it was very nice. And I just went back and forth and did the whole thing. And that is just the way it is to connect with our spiritual self. Just go and do it. Go and do those things that make you happy. And I drove the tractor. I ran the tractor. I pushed the dirt away. I leveled it out. There's a big pile of dirt ended in the middle of the road where I lifted up the gurney. And I thought, oh, I didn't mean to do that. I meant to take it off to the side. So I put down the front scoop and put it down just perfect so it just touched the road and shoved it all off of there just smooth as silk. And I thought, gee, Herb, you're good. You know, you're good. You're not perfect as you'd like to be, but you're good. You're very good. A couple more passes and you'll be perfect. But start believing in yourself. Now, I could have said, well, you know, Brian works the tractor quite nicely, and I should just let him do those things because he always does it so nice. Well, why can't I do it nice? Why can't I have a connection with the divine within me? Why can't I have this awareness and this knowledge of being able to do it just like anybody else? Why not? Because I haven't gone out and accepted the fact that I am one with all knowledge. I am one with all programming and planning. Now, all of you have done things like this in the past. All of you have known that you could do something, but you didn't do it because you felt you couldn't. I was looking at the work that JJ did, and JJ is in prison, and he's a very sincere person, and he wrote his thesis. And he's been writing his thesis now for several years. And he's been writing it in prison, and he cannot write it on a typewriter. He cannot write it with any special helps. He has to write it with a pen and paper, and so he has to make it as perfect as he can without having to make too many revised writings. Well, I said to him, I'm tired of waiting, JJ. If you don't get that thesis in now, I'm not going to pay any attention to it. I'm not going to read it if it doesn't come. And so, amazingly, within a week, he had it into me. He said he mailed it sooner, but it never came. But it finally came, and so that's fine. That's no problem. But then when I read it, I was flabbergasted. It was a beautiful piece of writing. It was erudite, but yet it was beautiful, and it was correct, and an excellent piece. So I told him it was excellent. He says, good. He acted just as though he knew that it was excellent. He acted just as though he realized that he had tuned into his divine and had written it from his divine. Just so he did that, you know. Now, is that a good thing to do? Or is that lacking in humility? I'm so used to working with people and working with people and working with people and helping them to achieve their goals and having them be so solicitous and so thankful for it while I'm doing it that when I run across a genius and he says, well, of course it's right. That's what I planned it to be. I've been working on it. You know, he sure has, you know. But we should be more like that. We don't need to say, oh, thank you for saying it's so wonderful, thank you for recognizing. We know it's good. Like the little boy, you say to him, my, you are an intelligent little boy. I know, you know. You little snip, don't you have any humility? And well, we don't want him to have humility. We want him to say, yes, I know. But you see, you know, it gets to your gut right away. Yeah, I know, you know. Yeah, you know, you want to spit it in the face. But that's what we've been taught. We've been taught that we should not say the truth about ourselves. And we should not say that we are good. We should not say that we are God. We should not say any of these things. Now, if you will read the Bible, and Rhonda says that she's read it many times, and Gertrude has read it many times, and Christina has read it a little bit. And Ingeborg, have you ever read the Bible? Well, we'll never know. And Sylvia, have you ever read the Bible? A little here and a little there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Ellen's the same way. Now, if ever you read the Bible from cover to cover, you will just be reading a book. You will read a book which has a lot of interesting things in it and a lot of uninteresting things in it. But it's just a book. So, no one can say to you that you haven't read it, if you read it. And then they will not try to explain it to you if you've read it. And that's another thing off your back. But no matter what, as I said to Rosalie, and I'll say it again and again because it's so important. I said, Rosalie, go to the university and take a course in philosophy. And as you take this course in philosophy, you think that you're a very stupid lady. All you have to do is ask intelligent questions. If they say to you, now this is a book by Kant, and it's his philosophical equations of life and how he feels that life is really a beautiful series of adventures and how we should take each one of these adventures in a personal way and enjoy it. And everyone's philosophy is unique for them. And then, Rosalie, you could say to the brilliant ones in the class, why did Kant have an attitude like that? You know, you could ask it about anybody. And then the brilliant ones will say, that's a good question. He had an attitude like that because that was how he was brought up by his parents, and it was the philosophy of his time. Well, if it was the philosophy of his time, and if he was brought up by his parents like that, why was it that others who were brought up by their parents just like that didn't come to that same conclusion? Well, now, boing, you know, these are just simple little questions. They're stupid questions asked by a stupid person who doesn't know the answer, in all innocence. And the people hearing the questions say, you are brilliant. You ask the most intensive questions that anyone could ever want to know. You see, brilliance is not known by the intelligence that we have. It's known by the wisdom that we have in asking questions. And so, unfortunately, Rosalie never took the course, but if she had, and if she had followed my suggestions, she would have been the star pupil of the class, because her questions would have been so profound that the people in the class would have said, that lady is amazing, that lady is fantastic, that lady is great, and she is. But you, too, are great. And so I say to you, ask yourself the questions about anything in your life that you want to know, and you will give yourself the answers because you know that you know that you know. So ask yourself the question, where did I put that pencil? And the answer will come to you. It's in your pocket. You know? You don't have to stop and think, where did I put it? Let's see, what was the last thing I was doing? I was, where did I put the pencil? And the answer comes to you without a lot of mental gyrations. You just immediately come up with the answer. And this is the beautiful thing about that. This is the beautiful thing that we all want to enter into. We want to be the master of ourselves. We want to make that connection, and we make that connection through any number of ways. And one of the ways is to ask ourselves the questions. Rosalie could have been the most beloved and profound student of her class if she had done that. But she must do that out of her own choice and her own intelligence. Because if she just does it of the few questions I gave her, she'd run out of ammunition very shortly. But if she does it because she is interested in the subject, she's interested in the students in the class, and she's interested to hear what they have to say, ask. You show appreciation, you show respect. You show respect for another person by asking intelligent questions and let them answer it and appreciate their answers. they will talk their heads off for you. They will tell you their whole life story. They'll tell you everything. You say, how did you get to be so wealthy? Oh, I just did this and this and this. Well, will you teach me how to do that? Sure, come on, I'll show you. Now, here's $100,000. Now, you're going to invest that as your money, and I'll invest it as mine, and let's see who's going to be the most successful, you know? And now, you're going to keep that. Wow, you know, pretty nice. But when you show sincere respect for another person's wisdom, the wisdom is yours. When you show sincere respect for the wisdom of the divine within you, it will be revealed to you. You understand? It is revealed to you because you are then open to it. Rosalie would say, that is far too intensive for me, far too beyond my nature to understand for me to ask questions like that. No, it isn't. You just be simple about it. You say, well, if Mr. Kant learned that from when he was a child, what sort of way did his mother tell him those things as a child? How did she express this ability to be yourself and have fun? You know, how did she express? And then they'll, that's a good thought. Of course, in those days, people did this way and this way. And then as soon as they're done playing their game and you're done listening, then you ask the next question. You say, now, if their mother's comments had a great deal to say, what about the diet, the food that they were eating? What sort of food were they eating? Did this contribute to the growth of their brain cells and to the growth of their understanding inside and stuff? Ask just all these silly questions, and you'll be amazed at the wonder that comes out. Ask those questions of the divine within you. Whatever it is you want to know. And the divine within you will reveal the way in which you can accomplish these things in unimaginable ways. It's just utterly fantastic. Yes, it's utterly fantastic. So I want you all to think about these things now. And as you prepare our supper tonight, I want you to prepare it with all your heart and all your soul and all your being, and I want you to prepare it from the point of view that God is eating at your table, and I'll be there. But you are there too. And I don't know, are you God too?
Yes.
Okay, then if all seven of us gods are at that table, that's going to be a supper to be remembered, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay, then let's remember it, and let's go to it, and let's have a great time, because we have made the connection with the divine. I love you. You're fantastic. Have a great one.
Thank you.